Shalom Aleichem, Chaver, welcome. This is the National Council of Young Israel for conference call number 116. We welcome everyone, and we welcome Rebbe. Thank you, Rebbe.
You're very welcome. Okay. Question one. When a chazan recites a Hoicha Kedusha, in our case, due to the minyan arriving with little time before Shkia, does he recite Lador Vador or Ata Kadosh at the end of Kedusha? He recites Lador Vador, as the Mishnah Berurah says in Siman Kuf Chav Dalad Siv Kot and Tes. Question two. I'm a rabbi in a shul with a large population in the summers due to our proximity to the ocean. Many members only live nearby in the spring and summer and spend winters in other communities or warmer climates. Giving a Shabbos HaGadol Shuvit Rasha Motzi Shabbos on Zoom will give me a wider audience and not so pressured to abbreviate the shiur. My predecessors were unsuccessful in bringing people back before Mincha, and people left if it occurred after Kiddush or after even a shul lunch. I began this rabbinic position a year ago during a relative height of COVID. Shabbos HaGadol was on Zoom, Motzi Shabbos, since people were still uncomfortable being in shul for extended times. I did Shabbos Shuv in shul in the morning, and people's patience ran thin. On the other hand, there's a Mesorah of Klal Yisrael, how these shiurim are given. What are my thoughts on the matter? It's permissible to postpone the Shabbos Shuv at Russia or Shabbos HaGadol at Russia to Motzi Shabbos, even if it's not on Zoom, even if it's in person, if you think it will achieve a greater audience. Things are different. Times change all the time. How much more so if you do it on Zoom and you get people from all over the world? It's not a fundamental change in the Mesorah. You know, the original Mesorah was the rabbi gave two drushes a year, sum total. That was it. This rabbi, I'm sure, gives a speech every single Shabbos. The Gedolim gave a speech twice a year. Shabbos HaGadol, Shabbos Shuvah, it lasted for hours and everyone came. It was a major event. And today, in many shuls, it's not such a major event. People aren't that so excited about it. And therefore, you have to attract them to come and to listen. Now, in my shul, I'm still giving this shul the way it always was given, except, of course, when you were on Zoom. So the first Shabbos HaGadol, the shul was closed. So, of course, everything was on Zoom on Motzi Shabbos. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I give a Shabbos HaGadol and Shuvah Drush in two parts. There's a halacha part for an hour before and a 45-minute shmooze after mincha. That's how it works in our shul. So, if I'm not mistaken, Shabbos HaGadol, when we were closed, I gave the shiur, I believe, on Thursday night, and I gave the shmooze Motzi Shabbos. That's my recollection. By the time Shabbos Shuvah ran around the first time, talking about Shabbos Shuvah 2020, the shul was open, but with very strong restrictions. It was social distancing. People couldn't pack it in. So if I'm not mistaken, the second part was certainly on Zoom Motzi Shabbos, so people could tune in. And I think the first part may have also been on Zoom. I don't remember. As the last year Shabbos HaGadol, things were already better. I went back to my regular routine of doing it in shul, and okay, that's the Mesorah we have in our shul, but the rabbi knows his own shul. It's permissible to do it on Motzi Shabbos. Three, a baby born last Monday afternoon would have to pinyon HaBen on Wednesday. Tanis Esther, can the pinyon wait until after Megillah reading to enable the pinyon to be part of the Suda when people can eat? Or must it be done before Shkia, with Suda later, detached time-wise from the pinyon? Family would like to know if they can have the pinyon on Purim Day. The answer to both questions is no. Can't have it Purim Day, can't have it Purim Night. It has to be done on the 31st day. So they should do it just before Mincha. And then the Suda will be, as soon as it gets dark, after the Megillah. Okay. Question number four. A couple that I have been mentoring for many years has approached me with that they now realize that the conservative marriage that they had years ago is questionable. I would like to know how to proceed. They're not looking for a full minyan ceremony for their own dignity and how it would reflect on their children who are now in wonderful yeshivas. I'm proposing having him give her kiddushin and writing a ksuba to Irkasa. Regarding just writing an original ksuba dated from now, they tell me that their recollection is that the first ksuba had a man friend and a woman friend as Adam. So, puzzle. Still, I'm not sure it's ideal to meet the creator Ksuba as if it is an original or a different document was written and signed at an earlier time. Is it possible to say any of the brachas if we do not have a minyan? Can we recite any of the brachas at a small meal, maybe just a mezuzah of three, in their honor? Also, they would prefer that her existing ring be used for the kiddushin. Can she gift it to him before the ceremony? Or can she gift it out of their family unit slash partnership to me or to the other aide, and then we gift it to the chosen for him to use for kiddushin? A very long-winded question, an important question. In my view, this couple that the rabbi has been mentoring for many years, it's very likely that they're married. You'll say, how can they be married? The first marriage was invalid. A man and a woman is witnesses for the ksuba. There could have been a man and a woman witnesses for the kiddushin too. And the conservative rabbi, I'm not sure if he was a kosher witness. I'm not sure if there was any other kosher witnesses who actually saw it. When it comes to a conservative rabbi, you can't rely on the fact it was done properly. So if the chosn and kallah are back to the audience, could be no one else saw the kiddushin. It was kosher liedus. Even if the rabbi was, there's only one. So it's very questionable whether they're married under the chuppah, which that's true. However, this couple has been frum for many years. And they realized, it took them a while to realize it, they probably realized it long before they actually had the guts to come to the rabbi, that the original marriage is questionable. We can then invoke a principle called Ein Odom Otsa Bilasa Bilasnus. That means that the couple wants to live together as a married couple. Now they know enough about orthodoxy to know that conservative is unacceptable. That was their intention. And although there are no witnesses, obviously, to the actual relation that they have, they go in and out of their house or apartment every single day. So everyone knows why they're going into their private residence. So it's very, very possible that they are married already now. And for this reason, I'm very upset. There was a psak some years back, a situation which was a very sad situation, an adulterous situation, and the adulterer was a kohen to make it worse, and a rabbi paskened that the original kedusha was no good because they weren't observant at the time. They were part of a conservative community. But the problem was they were now in an Orthodox shul for many years. And in my view, an Orthodox shul for many years, and they know that conservative is not so great, so they had in mind that they should live together for the sake of marriage. And everyone saw them going in and out of the house. So I thought that the psak was incorrect. And aside from being incorrect, it was also a very, very unseemly psak. But we're not going to go into that anymore. In any event, because we're not sure 100%, so we don't approach every single Baal Tshuva couple and say, let's marry off again. I don't know of any rabbi, I don't know of anybody, that they, thank God today's world there are many Baal Tshuva couples just about every shul. I don't know of any rabbi that makes this his business to go to every Baal Tshuva couple to say, hey, I'm going to marry all over again. I think they're justified in not doing that because they're assuming that the couple now became Orthodox, so ain't of the most will also be less. No, so they live together for the sake of Kiddushin. Nonetheless, not 100%. So if they request that you do the wedding again, of course you have to accede to their request. But it should only be a total of two witnesses there, the rabbi and one other person. No bracha should be made because they're, in my opinion, likely married already. And I think that the greater dignity that they're worried about is to have no meal, just the rabbi and one other person there. They write the ksuba, either write a ksuba chadasha, a totally new ksuba from today, or there's a form which is called ksuba di ishtakech bata'usa. It was a mistake in the ksuba. You could do one of those. You could also rip it up and make a ksuba di irkasa. But it's also possible to do a ksuba from right now, because until now we're not 100% sure they were married. We don't know for sure. So we can make a ksuba from that date. Makes it simpler. The same two witnesses, the rabbi and the other person, will sign on the ksuba. He'll give the ksuba to her when no one is looking, except for those two people. And it's 100% kosher marriage with a kosher ksuba. Going forward, this is what I believe should be done. as far as the wrinkle with the ring, that's a little more complicated. We're not happy with this kind of a situation. However, given this situation that she wants to do it, I think the eighth is that the ring should be sold by the woman to the rabbi. How do you sell? Like you sell chametz. You sell chametz. So the rabbi makes three separate kinyonim on the chametz. One, money is exchanged. Two, they shake hands, which is called situmta. And three, they do what we call chalipin, an item of value is exchanged. Those same three methods should be used in order to enable the rabbi to buy the ring from the chosin. He gives the chosin, money, gives him an item of value, and they shake hands. Now the ring belongs to the rabbi. Now you go, I misspoke. He has to get it, buy it from the kalam, from the woman, with those three methods. He gives her money, he gives her an item of value, momentarily, and they shake hands. Now that it belongs to the rabbi, he'll now sell it to the chosin with exactly the same methods. Chosin will give the rabbi money and give him an item of value, and they shake hands. Now it belongs to the chosin. He can use it in such a circumstance. Again, we don't like these things normally, but in this case, would be okay. Number five. What's my view on the Balkorei for Megillas Esther making different voices for the different characters or wearing different hats for different characters? Does that enhance or detract from the Mitzvah Sayom? This is what we call a case-specific question. It all depends on the community. In some communities, it'll be wonderful. Attractive attention when he mimics the voice of Haman and Ahasuerus and Esther and Mordechai, you know. That's going to be great. And some love it, and it's attractive to them. Others hate it. Each and every shul has to have its own, way of doing things. If the Balkorei wants to do it, he has to get permission from the Rav, who will then, figure out, is this a good thing or a bad thing, to engage the community to enjoy the Kriyas HaMegillah and pay attention to it. Number six, given the mass devastation worldwide of the coronavirus, especially in its earliest stages, two Purims ago, was there a need for a series of fasts as described in the Mishnah and Tanis? If not, why not? Very good question. Look at the Sefer Piskei Tshuvos, both in Siman Tov Kuf Ayin Aleph and Tov Kuf Ayin Vav. He says the minhag today is not to proclaim these fasts because people are weaker. Chalisha Tadoros. Nonetheless, those who remember that when COVID was in its initial crisis stage, there were some fasts. I believe there were actually two fasts, if I'm not mistaken, which were proclaimed by the Rabbanut and by the OU. They were half-day fasts. Now, a half-day fast, if you want to be a technical person, is not really a fast, because the Gemara has said, any Tanis Tibur, Shloshokol of Chama, is Eino Tanis. So you have to go to Shkia or later. Nonetheless, I thought it was a very good idea to have those half-day fasts, because it was, as the postman did quote, it's Ma'orel L'Tshuva. The fast, even a half a day, will be inspire someone to do tshuva. And what's the purpose of any fast? As the Rambam writes, is to do tshuva. So therefore, once again, the custom is not to proclaim these fasts, only on very rare occasions. Are they proclaimed? And likely it's better to have a half-day fast, even though it's technically not a fast, but it will suffice to lead to the ultimate goal, which is to do tshuva. Number seven. At Shabbos, Mincha, we called up a Levi for the first Aliyah, as no Kohen was in the shul. Immediately, you have to call up the Levi by name, and well before the bracha, the Kohen walked in. If the Levi was standing at the Shulchan when the Kohen walked in, according to Shulchan Aruch, the Kohen should take the Aliyah, and the Levi should stand on the Shulchan until he receives the second Aliyah. I was told by the Gabbai that the shul's minig was once the older was called up, he takes the Aliyah. Is there a source for this Mahalach? No. Not that I could find. I looked in the Shulchan Aruch, I looked in the Mishnah Berurah, And then I looked, I think, even in the Dirshu and the Pisgah Chumas. I think I looked in all those places. I didn't see any alternative. This is a minig betos. Not every minig. Not every minig is a proper minig. You know, Rabbi Natan was very critical of a particular minig. He said, you know, minig, if it's spelled backwards, all right, Gimel, Hey, Nun, Mem. You know what that means. So this is a, to my knowledge, this minig has no basis. If someone can enlighten me and it has a basis, I'll retract my statement next year. Number eight. Over the last few years, our shul has had our Sifrei Torah checked by two different sofrim. Both concur that the four Torahs, more than 50 years old, were found to be a puzzle and beyond repair. Is there a need for a procedure to follow to remove the Torahs from our Orem? They have been in the Orem for 30 plus years. There is talk of putting them in Geniza. How do you establish a Geniza? There's talk of burying them. What is the procedure? Could they be buried like other Shemites during Kfuras Meis? Should they be buried with the Atzei Chaim and Mantle? A Bar Mitzvah teacher asked to purchase a puzzle Sefer Torah to be used as a learning tool for the Bar Mitzvah boy. Is that mutter? Four different questions. There's no need for a procedure. If they're puzzle, they're puzzle. You can take them out of their own kodesh. Geniza. Geniza, Pashtus, is according to the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch, is burial. It's found both in the Yoredeya, Reish Kei Beis Yud, and it's also found in Arachaim Kufnun Dalet Hei. There it says, Gonzin Eitzel Tamad Chacham, which means you bury him near a Tamad Chacham. It's a big fight what that means. It means in the same actual grave or nearby. And many Svarim say we should put it further away from a Tamad Chacham these days. It also says in the Shulchan Aruch, you put the Sefer Torah into a Kli Cheres, some kind of earthenware receptacle. I looked in the Dirshu, number 28, in Kufnun Dalet. And according to Rabbi Yashiv, it's hard to get Kli Cheres. You put it into a plastic and put it into a wooden coffin. That's the equivalent. And that's what should be done in such a circumstance. Can a Bar Mitzvah teacher, with Atzei Chaim and Mantle? You don't have to. Maybe it's better to do without. I think that's the proper way it's usually done. And the want to buy the Sefer for a learning tool, it's nothing wrong with that. It's not as if it's, you know, Malam HaKodesh for Loma reason. It's going to be moored into the ground, literally, so at least to let it be used for Torah study. True, it's not an Aliyah and Shul, and there are poskim who are very much opposed to taking a Sefer Torah and reading from it when it's not an official Aliyah and Shul. It is a Pesach Sefer Torah. So I think that's perfectly permissible. Number nine. Question from the perspective of the parent and of the school. When a school offers a tuition discount for financial reasons, is the discounted amount considered a loan that the parent needs to pay back when they can, even if it's years after their child graduates? From the school perspective, do they have the right to keep billing the parents for this discount? From the parent's perspective, are they responsible to pay back the discounted amount? And if so, does that come before other tzedakah clauses? Does it make a difference how it is worded in the contract in terms of loan versus the school requests? Okay. So I believe that in most schools, when they offer a tuition discount for financial reasons, it's a discount. It's not a loan. It's a discount. It's not, unless they spell it out otherwise, it's not considered to be a loan. The parent has no obligation to pay it back years later when he has more money and the school wants the money. It's no obligation. They have no right to keep billing him if they didn't make up that condition in advance. The parents, are they responsible to pay back? No, not at all. At the same time, it's appropriate that a parent who has had benefit from the school with or without a tuition break should have what we call Hakara Tatov and should include the school where he studied, where his children studied, in his portfolio of tzedakah. When he gets a little bit more money, he's able to afford significant stucker. It happens very often. When parents bring up children, they're broke. Every last penny is spent on the children. When they become empty nesters, they have more available funds. Everyone knows that. It's true in the general population as well. So they have to give stucker. We like to give at least meiser, one-tenth. Some want to give one-fifth. So within that portfolio, of Stoka, which is, let's assume, Maisa, 10%. So something I believe should be apportioned to the school where you studied or where your children studied, especially if they need the money, they ask it for it. But there's not an obligation to give it to that particular school unless they said it's a loan. I haven't seen, again, I'm not an expert, I haven't seen the idea of a loan in the agreements that I've been aware of. So if it's not couched as a loan, it is not a loan. Number 10. Is there any issue with a man wearing a wedding band? I'm not asking about the double ring ceremony. That's a very sensitive question. And when I grew up, wasn't all that long ago, men from the Orthodox shuls did not, as a general rule, wear wedding bands. It was a rarity. Almost never. Almost never. So what changed in the last, let's say, 60 years? What changed? I'll tell you what changed. There's been a total shift in how outside society views gender roles. And there's been a tremendous push for what we call today egalitarianism. Some call it feminism. Either way, it rubs me as being inconsistent with Torah values. Not that Torah, chas v'shalom, considers women to be inferior. To the contrary, both my Rebbe of Soloveitchik and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein are on record very strongly that there's no distinction whatsoever in the Kedusha, the sanctity of a Jewish man and a Jewish woman. But being equal does not mean being identical. And there are significant differences in gender roles, which, you know, today's world is totally crazy. Everybody wants to choose their own gender, make up new ones. But put that aside. Because of the egalitarianism, I believe it became much more popular within the Orthodox community for men to wear wedding bands, because the woman typically wears a wedding band, although she's not also required. Why must the woman wear a wedding band? No such requirement. But if she does, so then, maybe it's the same way as I wear one to remind myself that I'm married to you, hubby. You should wear one to remind yourself that you're married to me. Again, you can't prohibit it completely. I do not believe it's what we call a beged isha. Maybe 60 years ago it was, because only women wore wedding bands. But today I don't believe it's true at all. But now there are probably billions of women wearing wedding bands, men wearing wedding bands. So I don't think it's a beged isha. I would say the expression I would use is ein ruach hachamim nocha imenu. I don't think that it's such a great thing that the Rabbanim should be happy with. I was told when I said this on a previous occasion that there were men who wear their wedding band to work to avoid being propositioned by females. I said, whoa, if that's the case, absolutely should be worn in the office to avoid this terrible nisayon, and you should absolutely wear it in the office, and when you leave the office, you take it out and put it in your pocket. So the next day when you come to the office. And I added, if indeed the wedding band is what's needed to avoid flirtatious women who are after you, then even more so must a single man wear a wedding band in the office. It's just to protect himself from women who are after him, then that protection is needed even more by a single man than by a married man. A married man I knew once told me that he was a doctor, and some nurse was trying to proposition him somewhere in the stairway in the hospital. And what he did was he took the ring, which was on his finger, and he twirled it around and around and around and around to say to this lady, get off, get out of my life, I'm married. So there is some truth to that, and then it can be worn in the place of work, but I do believe it's preferred that it not be worn when a person is not in the place of work. 11. What is halacha when two women are together regarding tznius? A, getting completely undressed to change in a semi-public place, such as a woman's only locker room at a gym or a pool. B, not a professional massage, but a personal non-sexual touch, such as when a woman is sad and another gives her a hug on her shoulder to cry on while both are fully clothed. Okay. Once again, I'm going to be an egalitarian. There's no difference to my mind between a man and a woman. Same thing. If you're in a semi-public place, so I've never been, Baruch Hashem, in a women's only locker room, but I've been in men's only locker room in gyms and pools, and I don't believe that we walked around totally undressed. I don't think so. If you obviously went to the shower, you were totally undressed, but as soon as you got out of the shower, you took a towel and wrapped it around, you know, just around the Mokom Ereva, and that, I think, is the proper way that sneers should be observed. And I believe that women should do exactly the same thing. If they're coming out of the pool or a shower, they should cover that part of the body with a towel and not be completely undressed, even though there are only women there. And I'll be honest with you, even if there's nobody there, if you look at the very beginning, some of you just started the Dirshe Mishnah Brura with the first page. We talk about how a person has to be careful, knowing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was everywhere. That's what the Ramah, Shvisi Hashem, the Negdi Tamid, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was always there. That's in Siman Aleph. And if you look a little bit further, maybe you haven't gotten there in the Dirshu, it's not in the first five pages, I don't think, but you will see it soon, that a person should be careful when he gets dressed and undressed not to explode the Mokom Erva. So obviously, if the person's in the shower, it's a different story. But if he's in a bedroom and no one else is there, or in a locker room, which is only all men or all women, doesn't matter. The Mokom Erva should not be exposed. Hug and a shoulder to cry on, that's a mitzvah. This is what both women and men have been doing since time immemorial. Now, of course, today, in today's crazy world, you have to be careful that it shouldn't be misinterpreted. But to say that a woman can't hug another woman when she's sad, that would be a travesty. Clearly, the intention is everything. Number 12. With Parsha Shkolim, one Parsha back from Parsha Vayakel, what is the right thing to do? Keep one Sefer Torah on the bima and roll it back? Or take out two Sefer Torah, give more kibbutzim for Hag B'Galila and Tzorach Nasa, but take up more time in shul? The answer is we do two svarim. Even though in this particular case, you're right, it would be faster to roll back from end of Vayakel to beginning of Kisisa, two parshas, two pretty long parshas, would still be faster than another Hag B'Galila. Doesn't matter. It's a low plug. Whenever there are a mafter, which is not from the parsha of Shavua, we use two svarim, unless there aren't any two svarim. But if the two svarim should be used, even though it'll take a few more seconds, then rolling back those two, just the Vayakel and Kisisa. 13. Yeshua has an aging population in the Midwest. With a few that are immunocompromised and will not attend shul for Megillah reading now or allow vax boosted by the Kriya into their home, they are asking for a Zoom Megillah reading, offering them a balkorah to read outside their window at 20 degrees Fahrenheit and possibly snowing will not work. The shul wants to reach out to these people by concern that those who should attend the shul mini will opt for the Zoom. How should I handle this? In my opinion, chas v'shalom to have a Zoom. A Zoom is not the right way to go. According to almost all authorities, one does not fulfill the mitzvah of the Megillah on the Zoom. So what do? Well, you do with the best you can. Who said it'll be 20 degrees and snowing on, it's a Shana Mubaris. Purim is well into March, towards the end of March. And let's hope it'll be better weather, even in the Midwest. And if it's not better weather, forget about Korah, we'll do it anyway. And if you can't forget about Korah, Rabbi, do it yourself. Yeah, that's what the rabbi's job is, to provide services for the community. Instead of Zooming, which is no good, you read the Megillah as many times as necessary outside the window. I remember when 2 years ago when we had COVID, so we had the shul was still open, but I read the Megillah twice that night for him because there were people who were in quarantine because they were teaching in Westchester schools. If you recall the new Rochelle outbreak of that initial terrible period, so I read in an apartment house outside the door. One of the individuals was behind the door, and one other person from the building sat behind me with back to me, and they both heard me read the Megillah. Then I went to another place to read the Megillah. There was a kippur and an immunocompromised lady, and I read it again. So that's the rabbi's job, to provide services if you can't find a balkorah. 14. Heisbel Garfield, New Jersey, for a ksuba. So Garfield is a bit of a dispute, whether you have Gimel Aleph Resh or Gimel Resh. They're both good. Some prefer the Aleph to emphasize the fact that it's an A sound. Others say no, in Yiddish, an A is usually, an Aleph is usually an O sound. So it would be Garfield. So most people, I think, spell it with an Aleph. Gimel Aleph Resh Fe Yud Lamed Aleph. Take the Aleph out, it's also good. And if you want to have New Jersey, Dim Dinas, that's how we typically write. Nu, we write in Yiddish, Nun Vav Aleph, Jersey. Now, I write it phonetically. Dalet Zayin Shin, that's how the Chassidim spell the G sound, with three consonants, Dalet Zayin Shin, Z. And then Erzi, it would be Ayin Reish Zayin Yud, New Jersey. That's how it's pronounced. So now I have to say, the Gittin, they write New Jersey. Because when they had Gittin 100 years ago, and the European Jews couldn't pronounce the Jersey, they said it's Jersey, so it remains. That's as far as Gittin are concerned. But as far as Ksubas, you should do it, I believe, phonetically. Number 15. What is the status of spice bottles or croutons poured into a hot bowl of fleshic soup? Would you need to wait after eating croutons from that bottle? If that spice is then used in the milchiga dish, what is the halacha? Is it different in the case of the solid food? For example, ketchup onto a hot piece of meat. Apparently the question is what about what we call Zeya. Zeya is found in Shulchan Aruch, Yoredeya, Simen Sadi, Bey, Sifches, Zayin and Ches, both talk a little bit about Zeya. We paskin it, strictly speaking, that the only time there's a problem is if the steam is so hot that the food on top, called spice bottles or croutons, will actually be so hot you can't touch it. Yad so lettuce bow. I believe that in most cases it would not reach yad so lettuce bow. If you're not sure with yad so lettuce bow, if you look at Rabbi Kiva Eger in Simon Sadi Beis, he seems to say that we only have to be strict if you're not sure if it's in a closed area. Totally enclosed. That's the Shulchan Aruch case. The Bach suggests that if it's an open area, there's never a problem there, no matter what. Rabbi Kiva Eger makes a pshara. If you know for a fact that yad so lettuce bow, we should maybe be strict. But if in most cases you don't know, so then we can be lenient. And therefore, in our situation, there's much, much room to be lenient. And therefore, to answer the question, the spice bottles and the croutons are likely still parv. You don't have to wait after eating those croutons. That's even a bigger leniency because the shach seems to say that even if you have tavshil, which does have a taste of meat, you still may not have to wait 6 hours. It's not completely clear if it goes in that direction, maybe only the other direction, but that's not to discuss right now. And certainly, if it's the spice is used in the middle of a dish, the halacha is that the food is kosher. We're not going to ask for the evidence. And solid food is even more permissible, because many people say that the Zayas Ochlin doesn't count. There really isn't that much Zayah when it comes to solid foods. There's much room to be lenient after the fact. I mean, ideally, perhaps it's better to take the spice or the croutons, put it in something which is parve, and then pour it onto the food, whether it be milchik or fleshik, in the hot soup. Finally, 16. Is there such a concept of being comfortable relying on hashgacha for certain things but not for others? For example, in a pizza shop, for the pizza to be kosher, protocol has to be followed. The ingredients stay the same. There is an issue of Bishul Yisrael. However, for the salad to be kosher, you're really relying on not only on proper protocol, but also that the Mashkiach Tamidi is performing at his best every day. Or do we say either trust Hashkacha or don't? Of course it's possible to distinguish. Hashkacha is not a halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai. A person can't say, well, I don't care, once there's a rabbi's name attached to it, I can eat whatever I want, it's the rabbi's fault. No, caveat emptor. It's up to the person who is eating the food to make sure that hashgacha is reliable. And there are many, many situations where a person has a stricter standard than the hashgacha in the store. So you have to be stricter with respect to certain things. For example, Bishul Yisrael. There are different standards for Ashkenazim and for Sephardim. So if you're a Sephardi, you probably can't eat in some perfectly kosher Ashkenazi restaurants. Doesn't meet your standard of Bishul Yisrael. Then there's the issue of Chol Yisrael. Some many restaurants are not insist on the challah of Yisrael. If you are, if you do, so you can't eat the dairy product. And the same thing with Yashin and Chodesh. And the same thing is true with the, what's implied over here with the Bidikas Toloim, checking for bugs. There's so many different standards. If you have a stricter standard than the operator of the business, so you ask him what his standard is. Check it out with the Rav you ask your questions to. And you can be more strict than the eatery. And you will you won't eat the, some of the vegetables in the pizza shop if you feel that they're not doing it the way you'd like them to do it. So fine. There's nothing wrong with eating the pizza and not eating the vegetables or the cooked dishes if you feel strongly that that's the appropriate thing to do. Thank you very much.
Rebbe, we thank you very much. Bezrat Hashem, we're on, I think, in 2 weeks. And
okay.
I'd like to hear from Rebbe again. Thank you very much.
Okay. All the
Take
best.
Take care.
Bye.
Thank
bye.
You.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.